This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Pop! If only the German striker had a name that lent itself to catchy headlines, but two classic strikers finishes from Alexandra Popp means it's England v Germany in the final of the Euros, which means we can look forward to 3 days of wholesome content focusing on the footballing rivalry between the two nations. We'll do all that where will the final be won and lost stuff and see how much Barry wants England to lose. Also today, Arsenal and Liverpool strongly represented on the panel. And good news for car park fans, Ben Fisher's here with a quickfire look ahead to the EFL, which starts on Friday night. All that plus a huge Wire apology from me, a huge Grant Holt apology from me, and Jens Lehmann takes a chainsaw to his neighbour's garage. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hello, Max Rushton.
Hello, Salon Andy Hickman.
Hello.
And welcome, Tim Stillman. It's been a long time, Tim.
Yeah, it certainly has. Thanks for having me back. I think the last time I did this was in the kind of the plush studios at The Guardian. So, yeah, excited to be back.
They've been completely mothballed and now we just sit in our own houses, which is very useful if any of you are planning to emigrate to Australia and want to keep your jobs. Let's start then with Germany beating France 2-1. Tim, we had Anita Asante on yesterday saying she had to play against Alexandra Popp and she still has nightmares about it. And we saw that yesterday, just quite how good she is.
Yeah, absolutely. Her story is really interesting, actually, because she was injured for a year coming into this tournament. And so Germany haven't been able to play with her for quite a long time. And in fact, this is her first ever Euros. Weirdly enough, she missed 2013 and 2017 through injury. So in a weird way, despite being one of the best players in the world over the last kind of 8 years or so, she'd kind of forgotten, really. And Germany have got all these other brilliant forwards, most of whom are now sitting on the bench, not able to get into the team because of Alexandra Popp. So, yeah, she works so, so hard to be able to get into not just the team in this tournament, but just to get in the squad at all. And, yeah, I mean, she's clearly been one of the best players in the tournament. I think you can see how much it mattered to her to get here, not just to get into the tournament, but to make an impact as well.
So six goals in five games now, which has never been done before. And so on, it sort of made me feel, you know, when COCOMs say they had no right to get that ball, like both goals, it sort of felt like she really wasn't favourite to get either of them.
Yeah, I think that's her, like, symbolic of how she's performed in this tournament, right? It wasn't necessarily her right to get in that team coming in from injury, and there, yeah, like Tim said, the journey to get into that team is just—it's kind of unbelievable. And then to perform how she has done has been incredible. So the two goals, I think the defender has to do better for the first one. And where is Wendy Renard at that for that first goal? Completely flowing out, which you don't really expect from her. And then the second header was just phenomenal. I think that is what she has, though. She's got so much power. She can beat people in the air. She can beat you getting first to the ball. And I think that's what's going to be really interesting on Sunday against Millie Bright, which arguably two of the best players in the tournament coming up head to head.
I just wanted to jump in on that as well with Popp, because the other thing that Popp's done, she solved a real problem for Germany. I've watched a lot of Germany over the last 2 years. I mean, if Germany win the final on Sunday on penalties, it will officially be the most German tournament win of all time. Because the story is basically the last 2 years, they've been completely underwhelming, haven't really had a clue what they're doing. They haven't had a balanced team. That, like, the issue they've had is for those front five positions, they've genuinely got 10 players who are all brilliant and they haven't found a balance. But Popp coming in has kind of balanced that front line for them, and she plays with Svenja Hütt, the right winger at club level, and has done for years and years. Her and Hütt have played for Wolfsburg for about 106 years or something. So they've got a real chemistry, and it's really, really sorted out a problem. So Germany, completely underwhelming for 2 years. The second the tournament starts, they decide that they can put it all together, which sounds ominous, really, doesn't it?
It really does. I liked... I like Wendy Renard taking it a step further. Normally, you know, when you know you lose your player or it's your fault, you sort of yell at a few people. But she like called a whole meeting of the whole team to say, "What were you all doing? It can't be anything to do with me."
I was like, I hope she's taking responsibility before she says anything else. You just in that moment, you've got to be like, right, guys, that one was my fault. But let's look forward. I expected her to do that.
Barry, did Germany's performance give you enough hope that England will get a hiding on Sunday?
I don't think they'll get a hiding. I mean, I have been critical of the almost unanimous gushing praise that England have got throughout this tournament. But I suppose thinking about it, they have deserved it because they haven't done a whole lot wrong. I do think they will have this could be a fascinating final. They could get a very tough game and they could lose. I know France did well enough last night, considering, they've had the ceremony in the camp before the tournament, two key players left out. Their manager has some feud going on with Lyon players that I don't really understand, but such. That's the way it is. Perhaps Tim or Sloan can explain more and enlighten me. They lost Marie-Antoinette Katoto to injury. And Wendy Reynard didn't have a very good game last night. She's their iconic player. She was at fault for both goals and missed with a far post header from a corner. She should have scored, I thought. Perhaps I'm being a little unfair on her, but I would expect better from someone of her stature, both physical and metaphorical. But I was very impressed with Germany. And it's Germany, you know. So I don't think if the England men's team won a Euros or a World Cup, I would genuinely be devastated. I will not be devastated if the England women win, but I think it would be disingenuous of me and possibly a little sexist to root for them just because they're England women. I should hold them in the same kind of contempt I hold the England men's team in. So, yeah, I'll be rooting for Germany.
Can one of you enlighten us on why the French manager doesn't like Lyon players? Tim, do you know that?
I don't think anyone knows, but basically this is the story of France. Corinne Diacre falls out with at least two players before every tournament. Last time it was Katoto, albeit Katoto was a bit younger, not quite as established as she is now, but she was left out of the last World Cup because she fell out with the manager. And yeah, so they left Eugène Le Sommer and Amandine Henry at home, who are two of the best players in the world. I'm pretty sure that they could have come in quite handy last night. And nobody really knows why Diacre keeps falling out with these players, why she's holding on to her job as a result of this, and why she hasn't worked out yet that maybe there's a common denominator in why she keeps falling out with all of these players. It's a mystery.
She just loves chaos. Like that Diacre just loves chaos. She wants to create it. She wants arguments between her team. It's absolutely nuts. I think that I would love to know what is going on behind the scenes to see how, like Tim said, she's still in a job and how she got this far. I thought it was really funny last night. She came out, she was like, you know, it's tough to take, but we do have to stick together post this result. And I was like, Were you ever together in the first place? It would have been good if you'd been together before the tournament, perhaps, and you might have got to that final. And it's a real shame because mismanagement at the top just means that so many of these players' international careers are just kind of never going to fulfil the potential that they have.
She seems like a kind of the female equivalent of, was it Domenech? Who was the
Raymond Domenech.
Raymond Domenech, the French manager who, just serially fell out with various players and was a bit weird.
Maybe she's selecting based on star sign as well, because that was one of Dominic's things, that he selected players based on their star sign. So maybe you've solved the mystery there, Baz. I don't know.
In to what sense he wanted sort of one of each, or like, you know, a minimum, you know, I can't have three Sagittarius.
Got to have Libras on each wing for the balance.
Absolutely. With Russell Grant as his assistant manager at work, wouldn't it? Apart from Alexandra Popp, Tim, who should who should England be worried about? You know, like, how, where is this game going to be won and lost, do you think?
Yeah, sure. Germany's midfield is really, really formidable. And another thing that happened coming into this tournament that weirdly did Germany a favour, as much as they've struggled to balance that front line because they have too many good players, it's been the same in midfield. And just before the tournament, they lost, I mean, I think their most talented player, Jennifer Marijan, to an ACL injury. In a weird way, that did them a favour because they've been struggling to balance having Sara de Brits and Marijan in the same team because those two players are very similar, play exactly the same position. And to give you an idea of their pedigree, Marijan played for Lyon, left. Lyon have signed Sara de Brits to replace her. So that's the kind of, they've got arguably the two best number 10s in the world. And actually losing one of them helped them balance that midfield. So now they've got de Brits, Lena Magul and Lena Oberdorf, who plays for Wolfsburg. And that is, but for me, by far the best midfield in this tournament. If you give Spain Alexia back, Spain have the best midfield in the tournament. But that midfield three, really, really formidable. And there's still a little nagging doubt in my mind about England's midfield. It's worked so much better than I thought it would with Walsh, Stanway and Kirby. But I do still think there are parts of games where they have been, it's probably too much to say passengers, but this is going to be the real, real test of that midfield. And the thing is, Germany, they suffocate you with that press.
And actually, Ceylon, you know, Bon Mati for Spain showed that, you know, that she sort of ran that game, I thought, against England for 80 minutes at least. And so if the German midfield have a, I don't know if they have a sort of like for like similar player, but if their midfield is at real strength, that could be a problem for England.
Yeah, Bon Mati just glued herself to Walsh, right? And so much of England's ability to play out from the back and then release the front three comes through Walsh receiving on the half turn and sending the balls over the top for our wingers. But yeah, they do. Oberdorf last night had an incredible game. I think she completely shut down that midfield. She's really physical, really aggressive. And I think her versus Georgia Stanway is going to be an absolute battle of the shithouses as well, which will be really brilliant to see. I think there was a challenge last night in the first half Oberdorf made where she genuinely looked like she'd come off both feet and sort of gone 2 feet in the air for someone's legs. Wasn't even looked at. So I might be just chatting rubbish, but it looked like the kind of challenge that I was like, that could be a red. But it's exactly the kind of thing that Stanway will do. She'll just track back and she'll put in these challenges where she'll win the ball and hook it from behind, sometimes concede a foul. But her versus Oberdorf in the midfield will be a really interesting matchup on Sunday.
Ceylon, at the start of the tournament, I think it was after the first game, we sort of talked about the emotions, you know, the tears before the Austria game. And Tim, you've covered the women's game for years and years and years. I just sort of wonder how you two will be feeling on Sunday in the build-up to the game, sort of regardless of how England get on, Tim.
Yeah, look, incredibly emotional. I'm going to the final with my mum. It's my mum that kind of introduced me to football, full stop, but to women's football in the kind of mid to late 90s. First time she took me, so that will be incredibly emotional. I'm not usually like a massive, like in England terms, I'm a complete glory hunter. It's not even just the tournaments. It's once you get into the knockout stages of the tournaments, all of a sudden you'll find me with a St. George's flag and, you know, dusting off my England shirt from the bottom of the drawer. But undoubtedly to me, and I loved the Euros last summer and I was at the Denmark game at Wembley, but undoubtedly this does have a little bit of extra because of the, you know, I guess the legacy perspective. And when I was at the Spain game, that's the thing I was worried about most. It wasn't so much about England going out. It was, oh God, if England go out in the first quarter final, like this tournament's going to kind of die on its arse a bit. And, you know, because the momentum, you can see the TV viewing figures, they just go up and up and up as it goes through the tournament. So undoubtedly it has an extra edge because of that. And yeah, being at a sold out Wembley for England-Germany final, that is 100%. That's going to be very, very emotional.
Yeah, I mean, I've cried a lot throughout the last 3 weeks. I have butterflies thinking about what it's going to be on Sunday. The steps that have, what we're seeing is the product of so much work and energy and labour from so many people that's gone into this tournament to create something and really put what deserves to be a spectacle on its right pedestal. And I think Sunday is the epitome of that. It kind of feels poetic. It feels right that it's Germany. I think it's the two best teams in the tournament. The script's written for it to be at Wembley. And almost it feels like the final hurdle for this England team to overcome. I feel like if we do that, we get the title of greatness. And I think it's like the deserved thing. I'm sorry, Barry, this is probably absolutely, you are hating this. But if we fail and we don't win, we're the same old England who disappoint and we go out to Germany. So it's kind of like the perfect setup. And it feels like this is the team to overcome that. And I think Sunday, yeah, it is just a product of so much energy and love that goes into the women's game. And what, for me, I noticed after the Spain game, where I was like, okay, these are the little hints that change or social change is kind of happening. One of my best mates, 35-year-old man, and he is, you know, his friendship group are all men. And he rang me after the Spain game and he wanted to talk for about 45 minutes about why Bonmatí was so good. Why are there no, he's a Spurs fan. Why are there no Spurs players in the England team? Why can't I get a Spurs player on my back? You're asking all these kind of questions. And then he was like, Solon, this is so different to anything I've experienced before. My group chat of all the lads from South London are texting saying, where are we watching the semi-final together? Are we going to get a pub, blah, 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 in full sincerity. And that he's like, I've never experienced that from my mates before. There's not even a message in there that's saying, oh, did you see the goalkeeper or anything like that? None of the tropes. And he was just like, that for me is change. And I was like, when you bring new audiences into it with the same credibility and the same authenticity that they would support the men's game in, I'm like, that's the moment of change. And this is what getting to the final then creates over and over and over again.
Tim spoke about legacy there, and this week is the 10th anniversary of the London 2012 Games, and at the time there was all this chat about legacy, and you had the opening ceremony directed by Danny Boyle, which, you know, trumpeted all that was great about merry old England, and that all that legacy talk turned out to be horseshit. There is no legacy, made due in no small part to the Tory government. Are ye concerned that in 10 years' time there may be no legacy from this tournament as far as women's football is concerned, whether England win or lose? I wouldn't necessarily say England losing would be a failure. I think it's important they got to the final, but I'm just wondering what you think.
Yeah, I think what was such a shame with the London 2012 outcome and follow-up was the whole chat about regeneration and investment in an area of East London right around that park, which has just become West Ham Stadium. So, and doesn't really feel like it's done anything for the surrounding local community. I think with this tournament, perhaps what the step change has been is that the product that people are watching is something that's so enjoyable and is, you know, for those 35-year-old men who maybe never considered watching women's football before, they're seeing something that feels similar to the caliber of men's football that they love so much. The technique, the physicality, the pace of the game, etc. Because of the levels of professionalisation that have gone into that, and England sort of leading the way in Europe in terms of professionalising our domestic league and therefore having the national success, I think what hopefully you see is investment, and obviously it's a massive assumption, and we're, yeah, resting on people then showing up week in, week out at the WSL or being invested in these players, watching it on TV. We've got the broadcast deals now. People can access, they can watch it. It's about whether they get down to those stadiums, and hopefully because of the caliber of what they've seen this tournament, that therefore is the legacy. People know the players. They've, you know, Steph from work, he's fallen in love with Bonmatí. He wants to watch her week in, week out. Those are the kind of things that you hope transition, which I think is probably the difference to the Olympics, obviously, which is, yeah, a completely different ballgame with the amount of sports being played.
Solon makes several good points there about people watching, but also, and there's been a lot written during this tournament about what the England team looks like. You know, and for example, England versus Sweden on Tuesday night, you know, the friend I was with, we were kind of saying this is like the blonde ponytail derby going on here. But there's lots been written about what the England team looks like, and, you know, where regional talent centres have shut down and things like that. That will be another important legacy point, I think. What does the England team look like? I mean, next year's the World Cup, so it probably won't look very different. The next Euros and the Euros after that, Where are these players coming from? And also not just about the England team. What about girls who aren't going to be England internationals, aren't going to be Lucy Bronze, who just want to play football, might play in the Championship? Is the structure there for women as well, who aren't necessarily elite talents, but just want to play football?
Yeah, that's the key. I mean, Ian Wright sort of made that point, didn't he, at the end, quite powerfully. But the FA's figures say, look, 63% of schools offer girls football and PE lessons. So, you know, and only 40% of schools offer girls regular extracurricular football. Now, part of that is funding for schools, right? But you would say, and I don't have the percentages for boys, but it's probably near 100, right, for both of those things. And so it's girls who watch Russo do that back heel, having the opportunity not just in the playground, but just in PE to go, right, you're going to play football. And that seems to be a real key part of it. Before we finish part one, Tim, want to hear about your coach journey, please, because you went to the semi-final and then you had what sounds like the most miserable experience of all time afterwards, but maybe you enjoyed it. I don't know.
Yeah, the earlier coaches were sold out. So I took a 4 a.m. coach from Sheffield back to London, which was subsequently delayed by half an hour because of the rail strikes. There was lots of traffic. And yeah, I mean, I'm 38 years old now. It's probably been about 10 years since I last stayed up all night. I mean, I have a 2-year-old, so I'm experienced at having my sleep interrupted, but to have none at all. Yesterday was a genuine struggle. I wondered if I might have to end up at A&E at some point, actually, with you know, the heart palpitations and the kind of falling asleep at my desk. So, yeah, it was an ordeal, but it was worth it.
How near to the coach toilet were you? And was because sometimes the door just is always swinging open and closed
on
right. The back of the coach.
I was on the upper deck. I was on the upper deck, but I was worried that I'd have to use it myself at some point. But fortunately, that didn't come about.
I was once on a coach when the driver just began, just went, no number twos on the coach. You were like, yeah.
It's the first rule of rock and roll, isn't it? No solids on the tour bus.
Yeah, absolutely unacceptable. Anyway, The Guardian Women's Football Weekly, they're doing a bonus final preview episode tomorrow, and then straight after the final on Sunday night. Faye will be on with Susie, Rack, Johnny Lou, Robin Cowan to discuss the result. God, busy day for Robin, isn't it? Surely she wants to, you know, she's just commentated on England winning the Euro. She should be able to go and have a drink, not do a podcast. We'll be doing a very similar thing on Monday. Make sure to get Guardian Women's Football Weekly. You search, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And presumably, if you're listening to this, you know how to get a podcast. That'll do for part one. Part two, we'll do a bit of Arsenal and Liverpool and start our EFL preview. Hi, Pod fans. Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. We're going to do the EFL preview in parts two and three. So Ben Fisher joins us. Hello, mate.
Hi, Max. How you doing?
Yeah, very good. Has your summer been incredibly busy, focusing on, you know, just noting every loan deal and transfer between every EFL club?
Yeah, just keeping a little glossary of things. I think, slowly cranking into gear and, looking forward to it now.
Okay, good. Well, look, we're going to do a bit of Arsenal Liverpool first, so you can sit back and just ease your way in to podcasting duties for another season. And this bit says Tim Stillman's Arsenal bit. You've tweeted a lot about Gabriel Jesus, Tim. How excited are you to see him in action?
Yeah, very. It's a signing I've advocated for a long time, and it's just one of those rare signings where it just so happens where I used to write about Brazilian football a lot. Like, I literally watched Gabriel Jesus' debut, so I feel almost this weird kind of avuncular attachment to the player because I've been watching him for so long and really, really highly rated him for such a long time. But the trouble with that is I now feel personally responsible for the signing, so if it doesn't work or if he misses a goal, my Twitter mentions column will look like I am responsible for that. So it does carry like a little bit of extra tension for me, but no. Hugely pleased.
Are you Mikel Arteta's due diligence? Is that is that what happened?
And I think quite possibly, yeah. But in all seriousness, like the side, Arsenal didn't have a very good number nine for quite a while, and now they have a very good number nine. Call me horribly pretentious, but I think that might help Arsenal to have a good number nine.
I can speak from experience in that I have a very similar relationship to Naby Keita. And it's not been fun, Tim, if they don't do too well. I watched a lot of the Bundesliga in the season. RB Leipzig were challenging in their first season in the Bundesliga. I think it was 16-17, I think it was. And when they were, yeah, it was challenging Bayern for the top spot. And I just fell in love with Naby Keita, tweeted about him a lot, flew to Germany to go and watch him play against Freiburg. He actually picked up a suspension. I didn't get to watch him. And then when the transfer came through, it was like, everyone saw it. I was like, oh my God, this is the moment. This is the moment that I've been waiting for my whole life. And then, yes, I'd said that he was going to get PFA Player of the Year, and that didn't happen. And it still hasn't really happened. So have fun, Tim. I'm sure it'll be fun for you.
You never know. It reminds me of when I was doing fantasy football on Sky, Sean Derry came on. I've probably told this story before, but Sean Derry came on, and then the next day Cambridge United sacked their manager. The next day Sean Derry rang me and said, is Cambridge United a good club? And then the next day, the chief executive of Cambridge United rang me and went, is Sean Derry a nice bloke? And I went, yeah. And then the next day, he was the manager of Cambridge United. I thought, that can't be it. That can't be, you know, I don't want any responsibility here. He did okay. Zinchenko as well, Tim, it's interesting, as Barry's mentioned before, sort of how City view Arsenal, and that, you know, we're not really worried about you. You can have our cast-offs. But everybody watched Zinchenko play centre mid for Ukraine against Scotland and have decided he's the best centre midfielder in the world because of that performance. He is a very good centre midfielder, and I think he will be good for you.
I think he's a really, really good addition. What's interesting about him is obviously he plays like either left back or that left central midfield. Arsenal have an issue at left back in that Kieran Tierney is always getting injured. So actually having a good left back there, again, call me pretentious, think that might work out. But the interesting thing about it is the two positions he plays have been held by such firm first choice picks in Xhaka and Tierney. And I think he just introduces, even in a world where Tierney doesn't get injured, he introduces competition to both of them that they've probably not had before, which is another reason I think it's another really interesting addition. Albeit, I do think that there is an air of truth in what Bas says about Manchester City being happy enough to sell to Arsenal.
You hammered Chelsea in pre-season.
So that means
you'll finish above them in the league. I mean, do you have confidence in top four? It feels a stretch, doesn't it? Given the business that Tottenham have done and Chelsea are buying, and Liverpool and City are obviously very good.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think Arsenal will probably do roughly the same as what they did last season in terms of points and things like that. And it will just depend on what the other teams do. So I agree. I think Spurs have added very well. Manchester United are a bit of an unknown quantity. Can they be as bad as they were last season? I mean, that would be a real stretch. And really, I think what we're doing at the moment is we're looking at Chelsea and thinking, can they be this season's Manchester United? Are they the ones that just completely blow up and finish sixth? Because the reality is both Arsenal and Tottenham need that. They need one of those two teams to just not have a very good season. And if that happens, I think it will basically just be a shootout between Arsenal and Spurs again.
Ceylon, it's the Community Shield on Saturday. I mean, that almost completely passed me by, which I guess is a sign that the Women's Euros is getting a lot of coverage. I presume you can shift your focus for a couple of hours on Saturday to Liverpool City.
Well, my mate just offered me a ticket and I was like, yeah, I'll do the Wembley doubleheader. I'm very excited for a Saturday, Sunday.
Too many big crowds
in
2 days.
He was like, no, it's at Leicester. So yeah,
is it?
Yeah, it's the King Power. Yeah.
What?
Yeah, see, it's completely passed you by.
It's in Leicester. Wow. Okay. Yeah. That's good to learn these things. That's what this podcast is for, isn't it?
So I'm weighing up. Do I want to do the up there and back in a day, and then the Euros final for pretty much the last game of Liverpool's pre-season? Really. I think I'll probably go because it will be good. But I honestly, same boat as you. I'm just so fixated on the England team. But I will get back into the Liverpool headspace. Although last night we did lose 1-0 to Salzburg. So we haven't had the best pre-season in terms of results, but it's how much meaning you draw from those, right?
There is a rail strike as well on Saturday, Salon, so I can recommend a good bus company.
4 a.m, yeah?
That'll get you 4 a.m on Sunday, should get you to Wembley for kickoff, yeah.
Just keep titties in the morning, Tim.
No, ideally, Salon would get that 4 a.m bus, drink all night, and then the front page of the Sun on Monday would be her in Trafalgar Square with the firecrackers sticking out of her nether regions.
Absolutely. My dad actually did tell me stories of when he travelled down from Liverpool to Wembley for an FA Cup final, and said that they got like, 3 a.m. coach or something, arrived at Wembley, Tinny's on the coach the whole way there, and then had played the same fixture in fans, I think it was Liverpool Everton FA Cup final, I can't remember, might be wrong, in the car park all morning. So we could recreate that. We could find some Germans, some England fans, get in the car park at Wembley from 8 a.m, tinnies in hand, and do that fixture first.
And then shove a firecracker. That's all Barry wants. Right, let's make Ben do some talking. The championship starts on Friday night. And I think a lot of people, there's a lot happening, you know, the Women's Euros, probably people have missed quite a lot of what has happened for sort of your casual EFL followers. I'm presuming if you are a Burnley fan, you know what your fixtures are, for example, and who you've signed and who you haven't. But what have been the sort of key movers in the championship, Ben?
Yeah, well, obviously Burnley, all eyes on Burnley, and Vincent Kompany probably more so on Friday. They kick off at Huddersfield, who obviously made the playoffs last year, 90 minutes away from doing it. I think Huddersfield themselves are interesting. They've lost their manager, Carlos Corberan. They've promoted from within, and Danny Schofield, who I think many people are kind of worried about them. And personally, I think they might do okay. I'm not saying they'll make the playoffs, but I think they can absorb those key departures, Lewis O'Brien and Harry Toffolo, who have both gone to Forest. And Schofield, somebody who I know Huddersfield think very highly of, in that he's helped people like Sorba Thomas, some of their better players, John Russell, come on, develop through the B team. So I think Huddersfield will be interesting. I think it's an interesting first game, in the sense for Burnley, Kompany seems it pains to maybe play down how strong they might be, certainly in the opening few weeks. Seems to want to preach a bit of realism. Obviously, they've lost an enormous amount of players. The whole defence is totally new, basically. And obviously Dwight McNeil and Maxwell Cornet are going to leave as well, it seems. So, yeah, lots of change at Burnley, but I think that's exciting in some ways. They want to go back to, I suppose, what they did many years ago in terms of recruitment, bringing in people who can improve and not sort of buy cheap, sell high, but more that way, I suppose. I mean, they spent good money on Scott Twine, the League One player of the season from MK Dons, so that's an exciting pickup. And I think Burnley, if it clicks, I think they'll be really successful. I just think there's going to be probably that initial teething period for Kompany and his players. I mean, the defence is very young. Couple of Man City players he's got in with obvious connections there. And I think that game on Friday actually is quite an interesting one to set the season up, because both teams are in, well, massive transition, really.
Normally it takes me about 3 months to sort of remember who the Watford manager is, and by that time they're no longer the Watford manager. But Rob Edwards from Forest Green seems like a sort of departure from what they've done before.
Yeah, massively. It doesn't feel very Watford, does it? I think I personally was surprised Rob Edwards went there for those reasons, really. Not probably the most stable club. Watford are saying, and I think the message behind the scenes is it's going to be different this time, but we've heard that before. The recruitment suggests maybe not. It's very left field again. Watford always seems a bit of a mishmash of a squad whenever you look at them, but even more so this year in the Championship. I mean, Ismail Assar, Manuel Dennis are still there. Whether they stay remains to be seen. I don't think either of them went away on their pre-season camp. So, yeah, Watford, I think I probably am the least confident about of those relegated teams, but I think purely because of some of the names they have got and some of the experience they have got, that they're probably going to be in the mix. That's kind of sadly how it works.
A summer without thinking about Steve Bruce, but he's still there and it's nice to think about him again. He's at West Brom. It says here, have recruited well. But I don't know the Community Shield is in Leicester. I don't know who West Brom have recruited. Tell me more.
Well, West Brom have got in Jed Wallace, who's been, you know, one of Millwall's best players for the last few years, and a good person as well, I think, which is helpful at West Brom. John Swift as well from Reading, who again has been, you know, top of the sort of assist charts and weighed in with a few goals. So I think those two should solve their problems going forward. They were quite painful to watch going forward last year. Carlin Grant in that league should sort of hoover up some of those chances that he'll now be hopefully getting. Daryl DK is returning to full fitness, which is a big plus. If that can work, it feels like they should be a shoo-in, you know, to be up there. The only thing is, as you say, there are question marks over Bruce. I don't think the fans are entirely having him. And it, you know, it needs to work because obviously it ended so badly at Newcastle. I mean, if this doesn't work...
Yeah, can't one set of fans just love Steve Bruce for Steve Bruce?
Love me for
like
who I am.
Wherever he goes now. That's what will happen. Barry, how are you feeling about Sunderland?
I'm cautiously optimistic. I think they'll be more than good enough to stay up. Whether or not they can trouble the playoff places remains to be seen. I'm not a huge fan of Alex Neil as a bloke, for no other reason than he was once rude to me when I asked him a question at a Norwich press conference.
Do you remember specifically what the question was?
No, can't remember. At all. No idea. But I may well have earned his wrath, but you know, I'm sure he doesn't remember that. But I'm a great man to hold a grudge, as you well know. But I'm prepared to look past that. I think he's a good manager. He has form in getting teams promoted from the championship. But yeah, I'd just a season of mid-table nothingness would be more than enough for me. I just wanted to ask Ben. Any championship previews I've read, they all have Middlesbrough read or heard, because I listened to our friends Ali and George from Not the Top 20. Their championship previews podcast is very good. Everyone has Middlesbrough to go up and Reading to go down. Would you agree with those assessments?
Yeah, I concur with that, Barry. I think Middlesbrough are the ones who, beyond the... I don't know, I suppose the relegated three and West Brom, I suppose, in that packet. I think Middlesbrough can compete. I think they'll challenge. Chris Wilder took over in November, did a brilliant job. Now he's obviously going to have, hopefully, a full season in charge. I think the interesting thing for them is what's the attacking department going to look like. Marcus Falls is going to join from Brentford, which I think is a really good get. Didn't quite happen for him on loan at Hull, but he scored loads of goals on loan at Wimbledon in a short spell a couple of years ago. I thought he might have had more of a looking at Brentford, but probably Tony and just the way Brentford play, usually with that one up, probably put pay to that. But Marcus Falls, if he can score goals for them, they're going to have a real chance. Ryan Giles, they've brought in on the left side in that wing-back system. I think Borough looked really sound. And I think Wilder's probably maybe the best manager in that league. So I'd fancy them, definitely.
And sorry, Reading... Everyone seems to have written them off before a ball has been kicked.
Yeah, well, even Paul Ince seems resigned to Reading going down, which is pretty ominous. Yeah, Reading have got problems. I mean, they're under embargo. It just feels, I don't know, quite tired there. And I don't know. I think I'd be amazed if they stay up. I think them in Birmingham are in for a real slog, to be honest.
Surely Noel and Stephen Hunt will get a few goals for Reading this season, won't they? You know, Dave Kitson could put in a couple. Michael says, Wigan, Rotherham, Sunderland. Whose car park does Ben think will make the best addition to the championship in terms of accessibility, affordability and overall quality of experience?
Oh, what a question. I have to say my...
What a question. You're absolutely right. Thank you, Michael.
My main concern, if I can sort of veer out of the Football League, is that Aston Villa have just bulldozed... my prime car park location on Brookvale Road because they're building a new satellite academy. So if any listeners have any top villa parking suggestions, I'm all in because, I'm out of ideas
are you
already.
Not like, are you not like, do you not get a park if you're covering a game? Do you not get a parking?
No, Max, this is, that's a myth. Sadly not.
Is that a myth? Yeah.
I bet Henry Winter gets one.
I don't think so. In fact, it's sad. I'm sad to say I can remember walking back to said car park with Henry last season. So definitely not.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. No. I any aficionados in the Aston Villa region, come and help, please. In terms of League One, I don't know. I don't think I've been to any of those car parks for a long time. My gut feeling would be Rotherham, but I don't know. You've thrown me.
Long old drive up to Sunderland. You want a nice bay, you know, just that gets you into the stadium with a minimum of fuss.
Well, I just like the fact that Ben Fisher has a gut feeling about Rotherham's car park. You know, he doesn't know, but I could just feel it in my bones. All right, look, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll do League One, League Two, and any other business. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. I'm very aware that these very quick little EFL previews. So apologies if you were desperate for hours and hours of League One coverage. Where have you got Cambridge United finishing, Ben, in League One?
I think they'll do okay. I think, I don't know, maybe 16th, 17th, something like that. I don't think they'll go down. Mark Bonner, as you know, Max has done a hell of a job there. I think second season's always maybe a bit of a big ask, but I think the teams coming up from League Two face an even bigger challenge for me. I think I feel a bit sorry for Forest Green, who've just been ravaged, really, victims of their own success. We know they're really ambitious, but I think it's a tough job for Ian Birchnell, who they've taken from Notts County and also managed Ostersunds not so long ago, like Graham Potter. But I think in League One, Sheffield Wednesday probably have a good say in things there. Darren Moore, I'm still maybe not entirely convinced, but probably wouldn't want to say that to his face, although he is very...
Oh, the second very, nicest man in football, very, Darren Moore, after nice Limboy Primus.
Yeah. I just like to say about Portsmouth, actually. Yesterday they got in Dane Scarlett on loan from Tottenham, who many championship clubs were after. I think many championship clubs probably thought they would get, actually. And for him to go on loan to League One seems pretty impressive. And that follows Colby Bishop, who they've taken from Accrington. Michael Morrison's coming on a free, really good experienced leader at the back. They've already got Joe Morrell, Ronan Curtis. Marlon Pack comes back to Portsmouth. They look to me like they could. This could be the year for Portsmouth. That last couple of days feels pretty significant for me.
Now, Peterborough have gone down to League One, which is excellent news. Tell me they're going to struggle.
Sadly not, Max. I think they're going to have one of those classic seasons where they probably go and rip it up. Going forward, they just have so much. I think lots of League One defences won't be able to handle that. They're a bit naive in the Championship, but in League One, I think they should, you know, outplay quite a few teams. They'll be on top of many teams. I think they'll do well. Derby as well, I think, will be interesting. Obviously, in the third tier for the first time since 86, Liam Rossini has sort of built a squad in a couple of weeks there. They still want to get new bodies through the door.
Do you think they'll give Rossini the job? Like, I mean, I really hope they do.
I think, sort of barring a disastrous start, yes, I think they would do that. It makes a lot of sense. A lot of the players he's brought in, him and Rooney, kind of worked together in sort of, what's the word, earmarked basically to bring in. Obviously, Rooney then left and Rossini, you know, his fingerprints were over some of those moves. So he knows a lot of the players. And I think as a coach, he's really well thought of. And now is obviously his chance to impress as a manager.
Give us some highlights from League Two, please, Ben.
Yeah, well, League Two, it just still feels bonkers that Mark Hughes is in League Two with Bradford. Every year, it seems Bradford are kind of set up to, you know, for big things. They don't really deliver. But this year, you'd like to think so. I mean, they brought Richie Smallwood in from Hull, who was a regular in the Championship last year, and the recruitment generally looks beyond, you know, what should be an Elite Two team, really. So you'd think they'd go close. Stockport coming up from the National League, real momentum there. Big spenders in the National League, let alone in League Two. I think they'll be up there. Northampton will probably go close. Obviously, they missed out on goals scored last season, which was a pretty painful ending for them.
Oh, it was amazing, wasn't it? It was like a 7-0.
A balmy finish at Bristol Rovers. They won 7-0 on the last day, and that meant Northampton lost out on the final day. I think, yeah, they'll be up there. I think Crawley Town could be an interesting team to watch. They've got new owners, an American consortium with roots in cryptocurrency. So it feels like that will go one of two ways.
I mean, it sounds like it'll go one of one way.
Well, that's the thing. You say that, Max. And, you know, I read their manifesto and it sounded like awful bullshit you'd expect from crypto bros. And they have this NFT they're selling or about to sell. But they seem to have made a suspiciously astute managerial appointment. in Kevin Betsy, who has previous at Arsenal. I don't know if you're familiar with his work, Tim.
Yeah, yeah. I was just going to make a gag about surely what will happen with Crawley is they'll start really, really well and really high and then suddenly just crash down to the bottom of the league overnight. But more seriously, yeah, Kevin Betsy was with Arsenal under-23s recently. Did a really, really good job, really highly rated there.
I also was speaking to Carol Bates, who's Crawley Old Girls like founder, the other day, and she was speaking very positively of the crypto investment and ownership. So seems like it's yeah, it's good with the fans and the volunteers and the community in there.
They're also letting the season ticket holders and NFT holders, which I'm still learning what that means, vote on which areas of the squad to strengthen, which feels pretty bonkers. But so far they have brought in Dom Telford, who was top scorer in the division last year, and the Swindon captain, Dion Conroy. So you can't sort of fault them in some ways, but I don't know, yeah.
If you ask fans who to buy, they'll only buy centre-forwards, right? It's just occasionally a number 10 and just centre-forward. They'll never buy a fullback.
Well, maybe Cristiano Ronaldo will find a home at Crawley Town.
I think they voted for a midfielder and then they brought in a defender and kind of made out he was a midfielder.
Oh, they just changed what he was. That's brilliant. I love that.
A bit like when Will Young won Pop Idol, but really it was Gareth Gates was the one that they backed.
Yeah, that's true. I was delighted for Will at the time because nobody gave him a sniff, did they? And his voice suited Evergreen more than Gareth Gates, I always thought.
Salon,
you're not having that?
Absolutely. It's like the biggest robbery of the 21st century.
Do you think? What, Gates losing Pop Idol?
Yeah.
And I was pleased for Will Young. Anyway, Eric says, mad Jens Lehmann tried to take down his neighbour's carport with a chainsaw. Thoughts? Jens Lehmann reportedly took a chainsaw to his neighbour's garage because it blocked his view of Lake Starnberg. This is according to Bild, the German news outlet. He has a long-running feud with his neighbour regarding their property. He's owned a property by the lake for 15 years, buying it for $4.2 million in 2007. Reports suggest he went next door with a chainsaw and severed the roof beams of the garage. He also attempted to switch off a surveillance camera to go undetected, but failed, and a live broadcast from the camera could be seen by the property's owner. I don't really have a follow-up question.
I think if I had a house that had a view of a nice lake and some fucker next door built a garage that blocked said view, I'd be inclined to take a chainsaw to it as well. I'm curious to know, did the neighbour have planning permission or not? I suppose much of what will happen, Jens, will hinge on that.
I don't think Jens Lehmann will care whether there was planning permission just to venture that. I mean, if you have a neighbour who's literally nickname his name is prefaced with the word mad, in inverted commas, mad Jens Lehmann. I'm not going to say he brought it on himself, but probably not a big surprise.
Which goalkeeper would you be most surprised to see taking a chainsaw to part of your property? And then you wandered downstairs.
John Ruddy.
John Ruddy's never going, I don't think John Ruddy is going to take a chainsaw.
I bet Dave Besson wouldn't do it either. He doesn't strike. He strikes me as more of a passive-aggressive note through the door.
I think Ben Foster would be incredibly reasonable and go, well, I didn't really like the lake view anyway. It's just a body of water.
Hope Solo would definitely do it.
Oh, yeah, that is true. And Peter Shilton might not do it, but he'd certainly talk about it a lot.
It's he wouldn't be able to get up high enough to get to the garage.
That is true, isn't it? Anthony says, can we get a mention of the Cinderella story in the US Open Cup tonight? Second Division Sacramento Republic beat Sporting Kansas City with a Panenka in the shootout. Hashtag a cup that still has magic. You absolutely can, Anthony. Congratulations to everyone at Sacramento Republic. Jack says, I'm looking for a full apology on the next pod for Grant Holt hating. Quote, a buffalo with the feet of a ballerina. Watch this goal versus Everton. He'd even queued it up for me at the right point on YouTube. Such was his eagerness for me to watch Grant Holt's very skillful goal for Norwich against Everton. It was. And maybe I should continue comparing Alessi Russo to Grant Holt. Also, an apology from me. To many people pointed out, the guy who said she in The Wire was Senator Claire Davis, not Bunk. It is 15 years since I watched The Wire. I'm amazed I could remember the name of any character. But yeah, my apologies.
I was listening to that pod and I winced when you said that.
My apologies to Senator Claire Davis. Jack says, as a Villa fan, I've listened to Jordan Jarrett Bryan and respected his opinions on Al Smith and others. I've bristled but respected. He's had some odd hot takes, but they're his opinion, to which he's entitled. But he crossed the line with not liking tiramisu. Hashtag outrage. Michael says, can we talk about Jordan Jarrett Bryan not liking RoboCop? I thought it was a strange choice of film. I don't recall thinking RoboCop was particularly good. Does anybody want to stand up and defend RoboCop here?
I have no strong feelings about RoboCop either way. It was a decent movie, but...
It did a job, yeah. Didn't it? It was a good whole... It was the Lee Catamole of movies, wasn't it? Finally, Shane says, does Barry reckon it's inevitable now that it'll be up to Offaly once more to stop this Kerry team making it five in a row? What sport are we talking about?
We're talking about Gaelic football, in right. which Offaly famously stopped Kerry doing an unprecedented five in a row back in 1982. And I don't think Offaly have troubled an All-Ireland final since. So I don't really follow Gaelic football. I'm a hurling snob, far more skillful, enjoyable viewing spectacle.
Can I just request that the Guardian Football Weekly stop shoving hurling and Gaelic football down my throat? I've had enough.
You absolutely can. It will never be mentioned again, Tim. That'll do for today. Thanks, Tim.
My pleasure, as always.
Enjoy the final. Thanks, Ceylon.
Thank you.
And you enjoy the double Wembley. Oh, no, it's not. Enjoy the King Power Wembley double. Barry, cheers.
Thank you, Max.
Thanks, Benny.
Thank you.
We'll be back on Monday. Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Christian Bennett.
This is The Guardian.